I'd like to discuss the string theory effective action. So as anticipated last week, I will do it by first asking the question, what happens if I try to consider strings which are moving in some complicated background? This is a question I can ask just about sort of free strings without even worrying about interactions in a sense. What, for example, how do I describe a string which is moving in a background with a non-trivial metric? Space-time with a non-trivial metric. So at any point of our derivation of the string in flat space, we could have tried to introduce a non-trivial background metric in space-time. For example, when I write down the Polyakov action, I could have said, okay, let me contract the space-time indices with some function of position. So classically, this makes definitely sense. It's still well invariant. In particular, it's scale invariant. This only happens in two dimensions. See, if I was studying a theory like this, but in more than two Schwarzschild dimensions, the scalar fields would have scaling dimension different from zero. For example, a scalar field in four dimensions has dimension one. And then this would be a function of some dimensionful quantity, and you would have to expand it into powers. So for example, suppose I write my metric. So I would essentially, to make sense of this, I would have to introduce some sort of a length scale here.
Mm-hmm. When you mean the string is moving on a non-trivial background, should the world sheet metric be something like H?
No, remember, H is just some completely auxiliary variable that we introduced to describe the number go to action.
But it's the metric on your world sheet.
Yes.
So if they're moving on some non-trivial background, wouldn't you expect that metric to be something which is not flat or conformally flat or something different?
This metric is whatever I want. Okay. Right? It's something we are going to do a path integral over. The classical equation for this metric will set it to be equal to the induced metric from the spacetime. That's true. This was not necessarily flat when the spacetime was flat, and it's still not necessarily flat now. All I was saying is that if for sure dimensional worksheet, this equation makes particularly good sense because the fields don't transform in any way when I do a scale transformation. So it's okay to put the generic function on the field. You can compare it to something you could study in. Suppose we're studying a four-dimensional scalar field theory, okay? Let me just call it phi, not even x. So we're studying some four-dimensional scalar field theory. Okay. Which sort of couplings make sense to add to this theory? Well, we know that you can add a potential of the function of your field, but you probably would not want to add something like this, say phi, then mu phi, then mu phi, because this is not renormalizable. If you want to write this, you need to put some scale in front of this, some dimensional coupling, some coupling with a negative dimension. Of course, something like this could make sense as an effective action. No, perhaps you have some complicated theory at high energy, and then at low energy you find some scalar fields with some non-renormalizable low-energy interactions. That's fine. But you would definitely study this just term by term. Each of these terms would be more and more irrelevant. On the other hand, in two dimensions, These are all marginal. All of these couplings would be marginal. So if I did this, then all of these couplings would be marginal. I could keep adding any powers here. So a scalar field theory in two dimensions has an infinite number of marginal operators that I can add to the action. Which means that if I start doing perturbative calculations in perturbation theory, I'll have to write down infinitely many beta functions for all these couplings. And so all these couplings will become functions of my scale after I look at the quantum theory. And I have some beta functions which will tell me how these couplings vary with the scale. Now this looks like a pretty complicated problem. It is definitely intricate, but it helps to rewrite everything in terms of just one function of my scalar field. Then I can ask, okay, quantum mechanically, how does this function depend on the scale when I do a normalization? So there will be some beta function. Too many mu's now. Let me call this lambda. So there will be some, all of these beta functions for the individual terms in my sum can be collected together into sort of functional beta function. If I want to continue with this notation, if I replace all of these guys by some function C phi, A phi, D phi, then I can collect all of these beta functions into beta function for C of phi. Okay. So in other words, although this is a nice one-invariant classical action, I can ask, is this one-invariant quantum mechanically? I'll have to do some calculations. I'll have to compute some beta functions. I can think about this beta function simply as what lives on the right-hand side of the, what is the value of the stress test, or the test of the stress test. Can try to do this calculation. Let's try to find what the beta function is for this cap.
Why does the beta function appear like this in the trace of the stress tensor?
Well, the trace of the stress tensor controls the behavior of the theory and the scale transformations. So in a sense, you know that the variation of the path integral under scale transformation is the same as inserting a T. On the other hand, the variation of the integral under a change in scale is also what happens when you change all the couplings. So let me write it here. So I've had my path integral. I can just do a gauge scale transformation explicitly, or I can just change the scale inside all my couplings. So one way is going to just give me the insertion of T in my path integral. And the other thing is just going to vary all the couplings in the action. I should have spoken. Excuse me, sorry. So you see that the stress of the stress tensor must be equal to the beta functions.
Is it always true that you can write it as a functional of C of phi? Like, what if it's some very weird non-linear combination?
Well, right, more or less, at this point, what I mean when I write this is this. Okay? Something that can be computed from C. What is this going to look like? We don't know until we do the calculation. And now you can actually start worrying, how do I actually do this calculation? Right? Because if I keep the action in this form, it's just not polynomial. I don't know what to do with it. Now, I can try to expand it in powers of x. I can pick some position, some place in space-time and say, OK, let me write g mu nu of x, let's say the origin, as eta mu nu plus x. Sigma x. I can always pick normal coordinates where the linear parts go away. I can try to do something like that. Doing a power theory around some position in space-time. Now, this makes sense only if I'm not moving too far. You know, this is actually a... Or if you want, if these higher terms are small. These terms are controlled essentially the curvature of your space-time. So this is going to be an expansion which makes sense if the curvature of space-time is not too big compared to the scale set by the string scale. So it's useful to bring back to write the string scale explicitly now. Okay, so let's just put the dimensionful quantity here explicitly, so that these are positions, mismeasured units of length. Then this becomes sort of a power theory in alpha prime. Okay. Sorry. No. Sorry. I'm not putting it here. I'm just standing like that. But then what you find is that there is an alpha prime. The beta function will start with alpha prime.
Why is it even number of x expansion?
No, it's not even. Here there are three.
Okay.
I could have put the linear term, I'm sorry. But the linear term can actually be eliminated by change of coordinates. It's a nice normal coordinate system where you can eliminate the linear path in x. So So this complicated thing can be studied perturbatively by expanding around the point. It becomes an expansion in alpha prime. And it works for curvature, which is small compared to the scale of this set by the string. And then you can compute the beta function. Is the power of C in alpha prime. It's not a terribly difficult calculation, although it's a bit tedious. Essentially, it's one loop process in this scalar field theory. So what is this telling us? It's telling us that at least at the leading order in this approximation, our theory is scale invariant and one invariant quantum mechanically only if the metric satisfies Einstein's equation. So you could have thought that you could study a string moving in any space-time, but it turns out that the string theory makes sense at the leading order only if the space-time is dynamic or satisfies Einstein's equations. Now, of course, in a sense, this makes sense because we know that the string theory has a graviton among the propagating modes. So the metric is actually dynamic. It makes sense that it satisfies the equation of motion. Sort of agrees the linearized order with the equations for the graph. But it still might seem quite surprising to get to it like this. So you can ask, well, what's the relation between the fact that you had a graviton in the spectrum and the fact that you found this equation? Well, you can understand a bit this a bit better if you just sort of think about it from the point of view of BLST quantization. So you can ask, okay, at the leading order, suppose that, again, I'm studying a small perturbation around a flat metric. Which has this. When is the disaction is BLST invariant? When is the this problem is BLST invariant? So I have my usual path integral, I have e to the action, and then there is a change in the action, which at the leading order I can just bring down. So you see that at the leading order, this looks a lot like a calculation where I insert an extra vertex operator on my worksheet. This vertex operator is precisely the vertex operator of we associated to the gravitons, so, especially if you Fourier expand this fluctuation of the metric. So you see that at the leading order, this makes sense if this is BLST closed. So the fact that we find the equations of motion for a graviton in the beta function makes sense. It makes sense because here we are checking the condition for wide invariance, and in particular BLST invariance. But if you expand at the leading order, the rest invariance is just the condition that this is on shell, that this fluctuation is on shell. Now, if you try to do things non-linearly, you can try to do things, for example, order by order in delta G mu, and try to reconstruct the full non-linear equations of motion and recover that. So this is sort of the relation between constraints you find on the vertex operators, on shell conditions of vertex operators, and information that comes from looking at the propagation of the string in the background. Another way you can think about this is that this is sort of a coherent state for this small fluctuation. In quantum field theory, if I want to describe a situation where some field has been turned on, I can start from the vacuum. At a vacuum, I want to just add a small fluctuation. I do something like this. I take some creation operator and I act on my state, right? On my vacuum. If I want to create a wave of some shape, I can put some wave function acting on the vacuum. But if I want to create an expectation value for my field, the simplest way is to exponentiate the creation operator. If you do something like this, you create something that has an expectation value for your field. Once it's exponentiated, essentially, it also it sort of ends up being added. So in a similar way, if you want to study the propagation of a string inside in a background of gravitons, you can add a graviton, you can add two, you can add three. You want to add really infinitely many. So you study your amplitude with no gravitons plus the amplitude with one graviton added plus one half the amplitude with two gravitons added, and so on and so forth. So to exponentiate this background of gravitons.
Mm-hmm. But the gravitons are some excited state of the string itself, and not the fluctuation of the background, don't they?
No, the gravitons are particles in the string theory. So each graviton is one string. So what I'm doing here, I'm saying, okay, well, let's time the propagation in the background of gravitons. So I might have no strings there, one string, two string, four, three string, four strings, and so on, all in this state of being one graviton.
So the picture is that many gravitons moving on the background effectively looks like a non-trivial background.
That's right. So if you're propagating in the presence of a lot of gravitons, it's the same as propagating the non-trivial metric.
So fundamentally, the background is taken to be flat in this picture.
Yes, this is all perturbative. So in perturbation theory, if I want to describe a non-trivial metric, I would say, okay, I put a lot of gravitons, and together they mimic the effect of a non-trivial metric. They are. By definition. So in a similar way, if I do my path integral plus the path integral with an insertion of a graviton vertex operator, and then I do the path integral with the insertion of two graviton vertex operators, and so on, I will essentially end up with a path integral in a modified background. So I discussed this for gravitons, but I could have used any other vertex operators on my theory. Right? In particular, I could have used, for example, the B-field vertex operator, or the dilaton vertex operator, or the tachyon vertex operator if I was sufficiently annoying. And I want to turn on the background for the tachyon. Possibly even the, you know, even turning on modes for the Higer string excitations. Although in that case, you probably wouldn't expect to have any sort of nice perturbation theory of this sort, because those strings have masses of order alpha prime. But in a sense, okay. So we can ask what happens. So we can remind ourselves of what were the vertex operators of various modes. For example, for the tachyon, the states were just pure momentum modes. Let me forget the ghosts for a moment. But. So the vertex operators in the integrated form look just like this. And so the end point is that inserting a tachyon means adding this to the action. See, this is a tachyon is essentially turning on a background for the tachyon is the same as turning on a potential for the scalar fields that describe the position of the string in space-time. Turning on a tachyon tries to prevent the string from going somewhere. If you turn a tachyon here, you'll prevent the string from going here. Unfortunately, so the tachyon represents an instability of string theory, of bosonic string, because it's a tachyon. We don't know what the endpoint of that instability is, but it seems to more or less destroy space-time, making it impossible for strings to propagate anywhere. Okay, this is not perhaps more very interesting. Now the B field. B field, graviton, and dilaton all came together in a package like this. They corresponded to vertex operators of this form. This was symmetric, traceless, anti-symmetric, or pure trace, roughly. In particular, the B field. So we saw what the change in the metric does, what the graviton does. The B field is coupled much in the same way, except that now it's a true form. So this is anti-symmetric. Well, this is symmetric. The dilaton is a little tricky, it turns out. It's very easy to mix it up with the graviton in doing calculations. So the way the dilaton appears, if you want to do things from first principle in the sense of writing an action that propagates in a generic background, let me put back the metric. Okay. Notice this is anti-symmetric, so here I contracted anti-symmetric tensor. I don't even need the metric on the worksheet here. But for the dilaton, what happens is that when you do calculations with this sort of action, you find you do the renormalization, you try to impose Wallin invariance, you find some that you need to add some extra counter terms at one loop. You end up with some very funny counter term, which looks like these. Here was everywhere over another alpha prime, but not here. Okay, so in the sort of most straightforward way to do things, you introduce your background metric, you introduce the background B field, and then you discover that you need to add this extra counter term to make things work at one loop order. And this is the coupling of the dilaton in the background. So it's proportional to the curvature on the worksheet, so it's easy to miss. If you do a calculation on a flat worksheet, you'll miss it easily. It has a very interesting feature that if you take the dilaton to be constant in space-time, this just integrates to give you the a number which depends only on the topology. So if you remember, your scattering amplitudes were schematically described by calculations in some on various worksheets. So this was a three-level process. Then there was a one-loop process. And a two-loop process. Etc. We can put some coupling here. For example, in a tree process, this was something which looks schematically like this. Right, with three interactions. So you put an interaction cubed here. Maybe here you put interaction to the fifth, because it looks like this. Here interaction to the seventh, and so on and so forth. But if you include this coupling, and you look what is the integral of the curvature on this worksheet, or this worksheet, or this worksheet, you find that the answer is precisely 3 for this worksheet, 5 for this worksheet, 7 for this worksheet. Essentially, every loop changes the number by 2, and every external leg changes it by 1. So it has the same combinatorics as the interaction. So essentially, changing the value of the dilaton ends up changing the value of your interaction strength. And if your dilaton is position dependent, the strength of your interactions will depend on where you are in space-time. So this demonstration of the fact that I mentioned the first week, that in string theory, there is pretty much one-to-one correspondence between the sort of backgrounds, the continuous choices that you can make when you define your string theory, and the excitations of the strings. And this somehow happens in some very non-trivial way through Wallin invariance. It somehow ties together the conditions for an excitation of your string to be on shell, and the condition for a background to be valid. So after you do this, you can write down beta functions for all your backgrounds. So you can write beta functions for your tachyon, beta functions for your B field, beta function for your metric, beta function for your dilaton. Each of them are going to be some functions of the metric, the tachyon, the dilaton, the B field, expanded in power series in alpha prime. So at least again, when the metric is almost flat, the B field is not too strong, the dilaton doesn't change too fast, and this sort of expansion in alpha prime makes sense, you find that all the conditions that the beta functions vanish can be expressed in terms of an effective action. I don't know what name to give it. It's really not the same thing as the action on the worksheet. It's really some effective action of the fields. Maybe not the tachyon. Now, the fact that the vanishing of the beta functions can be written as variation of equation of motion for some effective action is far from obvious. Okay? It's not clear that the beta function for some coupling should be the gradient of some function with respect to that coupling. But it does happen. In a sense, part of the reason you know that it must happen is because string theory behaves like quantum field theory at low energy, and the quantum field theory at low energy has an effective action. And the action that you find looks like this. So it's some action of the metric dilaton and B field. The one that you get at first sight looks a bit strange because you wouldn't really expect a dilaton here in an Einstein action. But it's easy to redefine the metric in a way that to make this disappear. So there is a redefinition. It looks like G mu nu equal to e to the sum power of phi, e to the multiple of phi g tilde mu nu. And then the action would become more standard. But this metric G, in a sense, is. So this is always true when you have a scalar field and a metric in a theory of general relativity. You can always redefine your metric in terms of your scalar field. And different choices might be useful for different purposes. This particular Chersot metric is the one that appears in the sigma model. If you express the sigma model in terms of the Einstein metric, then you will need to put some power, some e to the phi here, which will be okay. It will be just a redefinition of your fields. But so this is usually called the string metric. It's the metric that is felt by strings in the most classical way. So it's the string in the, it's a string frame for the metric. And this is the Einstein frame, the frame in which the metric behaves like a normal metric.
This looks a lot like the Philipsack line action, where you have a particle moving, let's say, in five dimensions, where you have a compacted five dimensional energy.
That's right. That's an example.
What is the exact link between? So here you have a string generating effective action.
Well, at this stage, there is no direct link for the bosonic string. If I have written the same effective action for what's called type 2A, then the resemblance to the Kunze-Klein action will be really striking, because there will be also one form field. And indeed, it's an indication that type 2A can be interpreted as an 11-dimensional theory, you know, a theory in one more dimension called M theory, compactified in a circle. So in that case, the radius of the circle becomes the dilaton. Somehow, when the string theory is weakly coupled, the circle is very tiny. When the string theory becomes, if you try to make the string theory very strongly coupled, then the circle grows big, and you recover M theory. Now, as we talk about circle compactifications, there is something else we can say at this point. We could discuss t-duality. So all of this was to discuss the propagation of a string in a background which is weakly curved, where all characteristic scales are much larger than the scale of a string. Okay, so we are studying tiny strings moving in a slowly varying gravitational background. So essentially doing quantum field theory still. We're not seeing anything really intrinsically stringy. We found the effective action for gravitons, you know. Couldn't have been anything else, because in quantum field theory, whenever you have gravitons, you end up in an effective action that looks like this. So you want to see something that is very stringy, then you need to look at a situation where the metric, where your space-time has some in characteristic scale, which is comparable to the size of the string. Now, we could try to do this by curvature. For example, we could say, okay, what happens if my spacetime has a big lump of curvature here of the size of a string? But that would be tough, because it would mean studying that action over there in a situation where it really have no control on it. Something simpler is to study a spacetime which is still flat, where everything is still quadratic and free, but also has a non-trivial scale. How to do that? Well, we just take a space-time which has a circle. So instead of studying a string moving in 26 flat directions, we could study a string moving in 25 flat directions plus times a circle. So how do we do that? So, t-duality. So we're going to study the propagation of a string in R 24,1 times a circle of radius R. Sorry for all the R's that will be floating around. This R is not the curvature. It's not the curvature on the worksheet. It's just the radius of our circle. So we're going to use the usual action. But now, the 25th direction must be identified under translations of 2πr. Let me call x25 just as y. For simplicity. So we should just repeat all the exercise we did before for studying a scalar field, for a scalar field which is valued in a circle. So for example, so the equations of motion of the scalar field are going to be the same. The expansion in modes of the scalar field is going to be almost the same. All the changes is the zero mode. The point is the center of mass of the, let me just write it. So when I write the same exact thing I wrote before, I need to do two changes. Okay. The first change is that because this mode now is compact, this mode lives in a circle, just as you do for a particle in a circle, the momentum will have to be quantized. So P is quantized. So I should write P as M over R. This is P for Y, okay? Maybe I should just call this Y. The second change is that because Y is defined up to 2πr, when I study my cylinder propagation or sheet, it's perfectly possible that as I go around the cylinder, y goes to y plus 2πr, or plus 4πr, or minus 4πr. So when we were studying the scalar field on the cylinder, we were imposing some boundary conditions, which for a normal scalar field would have been that phi at 2πi, y at 2πi is the same as y at 0. But now we need to allow some, what something is called winding. So I should be able to consider states in our Hilbert space where the scalar field y winds w times around as I around the target as I move around the worksheet. So this is literally winding. You should imagine you have this circle in space-time, and your string can just wrap a few times around that circle, w times around that circle. So this is included by a term that looks like this. See, as sigma shifts by 2πi, y of sigma will shift by 2πi rw. So these are two crucial differences. When I have a string moving in a space-time which has a circle, the momentum in the direction becomes quantized. Okay, that's boring, the same thing happens for particles. But now I have extra modes of strings winding around the circle, and that's new. So with this definition, A0 is not just equal to P as it was before, so A0 and A0 bar are now different, and so are L0 and L0 bar of my ground states. My ground states are now going to be labeled by the quantized momentum and the winding. Now, if you look at this formula, you see that L0 minus L0 bar for the ground states, which used to be 0, now is 2 mw. Because when I square these, I get mw. Right? I square these, I get mw, divide by 2, take this difference. So now I'll be allowed to put different number of oscillators on top of the left movers and right movers when I try to get my on-shell condition. So let's write some on-shell conditions. So now we have this this setup. We can try to study the spectrum of the strings. Okay. So I could say, okay, I'll start with something like this. Okay. When is this on shell? Well, so I need L0 and L0 bar to be both 1. They get a contribution from the momentum in the other directions, and from M and W. Either this is going to work either if M equal to 0 or W equal to 0. So that L0 minus L0 bar vanish. So here I get P squared plus M over R squared equal to 2. Here I get P squared plus WR over 2 squared equal to 2. So my tachyon has now broken down in a whole bunch of Kaluza-Klein modes. This is familiar. But I also gain some extra mysterious modes. These modes are very massive when the radius is very large. But as the radius starts going smaller and smaller, and the Kaluza-Klein modes start going higher and higher in mass, these guys are starting to go down in mass. Then I can look at things like this. So now, notice I put only an oscillator on the left and not on the right. So this contributes 1 to a 0, but not to a 0 bar. So this will work if MW is 1. So I get something new. So I'm getting all sorts of new stuff. I'm not just getting the Kaluza-Klein modes of the original flat space modes. And all these new modes start becoming more and more interesting as the radius becomes small. So what's happening? I start with a space-time with a big circle inside, and I see just normal particles moving around at low energy. I make the circle smaller and smaller. When it gets of order comparable to the string scale, the Kaluza-Klein modes have gotten rather heavy, and these other new modes have come down more or less to the same mass. I try to make it smaller than the string radius scale. These Kaluza-Klein modes keep going up, as in a quantum field theory. But these other modes are becoming very light. These winding modes are becoming very light. So at some point, the winding modes start playing exactly the same role as the momentum modes were playing when the radius was large. Indeed, I can just take this information, the whole quantum field theory, and repackage it in a different way. I can define a new field, y tilde. The same sum in there, but there are two pluses now. Okay, I'm not going to write it. So this new field satisfies the same equation of motion as the old field. But it sort of switched around the role of momentum and winding. So expressing in terms of this new field, the theory at some large values of the radius has become identical to the theory at some very small value of the radius, when winding modes and momentum modes have exchanged their roles. So essentially, this is telling you that as you try to make the circle smaller and smaller, at some point your theory is starting to behave as the radius was actually big. So as you keep going as r goes to zero, you go back to a flat space of 26 dimensions. So this is very different from what happens in quantum field theory. In quantum field theory, if you take a quantum field theory, you put it on a circle, you make the radius small. If you feel quantum field theory started, say, in four dimensions, by the time the radius goes to zero, you get a three-dimensional theory, quantum field theory. In string theory, that would be quite strange because we know that the strings have to propagate in 26 dimensions. So what's happening is that if you try to make one of the directions very small, it pops back up in a dual way. You go back to a 26-dimensional space-time. And all the fields get rearranged. Some of them got lost. Some came from infinities, from large masses in terms of winding modes. And everything gets repackaged again into flat space theory. So this is called T-duality. It's essentially the only string duality that you can see at weak coupling in perturbation theory. Well, one of a set of dualities you can see at weak coupling. You can study more complicated problems where you have several circles. If you are strong enough, you could even imagine doing calculations in that kind of theory, right? With a generic metric, which sometimes is nice and smooth, sometimes you get smaller. And in some situations, you get other examples of this phenomenon. So so within string perturbation theory, just thanks to T-duality, you can deal with some situations where your usual intuition was broken down. For example, I know you can ask, exactly what happens. So let me say this right. In a theory of quantum gravity, for example, you could imagine that things would break down when the size of the circle becomes the size of a Planck scale. And something completely new will happen. In string perturbation theory, a perturbation theory kicks in much earlier when you're still at the string scale and cures the small circle by opening it up into a different dual circle. Now, you can create situations where this is not working. You can create situations where perturbative string theory gets in trouble, where you shrink some parts of space-time in a way that is too troublesome for string perturbation theory to deal with. In those situations, non-perturbative effects come in, new dualities which are not visible in perturbation theory. But those new dualities, the new effects will be visible thanks to something called D-brains. So you will still be able to see some glimpse of those dualities, some hints, by introducing something called D-brains into string perturbation theory. And this will be tomorrow's lecture.